Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating Atlanta's heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of Atlanta's elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Brad. It's a very chilly February 17th. I've got Sam Grass and Lee Cantor in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Brad. How are you this morning?
Doing well. Trying to stay warm, but doing well. How about y'all?
I don't like the cold, Brad. Make it go away.
I can't remember a year when I've wanted spring to be here more.
Okay, Brad, what do you have for us today for useless trivia?
You know, it was another slow trivia day, but I do have a few things. The most interesting thing that happened on February 17th that I could find was in 1753 in Sweden, February 17th was followed by March 1st. So they lost 11 days.
Wow. Well, was that to catch up the calendar?
They moved from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar. So I don't know what happened to those. Hopefully nobody had meetings scheduled.
Or birthdays.
Those.
How would you like to have
that's
your birthday?
That's what I was going to say. Over the course of a lifetime, you end up being 10 years younger than you actually are.
There you go. 1933, first edition of Newsweek was published on this day. And couple of birthdays today. Michael Jordan is 47 and Paris Hilton is 29.
Oh, good to know. Happy birthday, Paris.
Okay, now segue to
I doubt if she's growing up, but there you go. We've got a great lineup today. Today we have two individuals from the Fuqua Center for Late Life Depression. We have Eve Bird, the executive director, and Adriana Hermida, who is assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science and also the associate director of the Geriatric Psychiatry Fellowship. And from Emory Eastside Heritage, we have Jamie Lackey, who is a clinical social worker. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you all for being here. We are going to talk to Eve Bird first. So good morning, Eve. Thank you for being here this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Eve, maybe you can just start by giving us a little background on yourself and how you came to be in the field that you're in and where you're at now, and just get started that way.
Well, I'm the executive director of the Fuqua Center for Late Life Depression, which is a part of the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry at Emory University School of Medicine. Our clinical work that we do is with Emory Healthcare. Division of Geriatric Psychiatry. I'm a practicing nurse practitioner, graduate of Emory School of Nursing, and also have my graduate degree in public health, master's in public health and health policy. I've been with the Fuqua Center since its inception in 1999 when Mr. J.B. Fuqua, a well-known Atlanta philanthropist, provided several million dollars to found the center. And the purpose of our center is to provide community education in an effort to decrease stigma related to mental illness in older adults and to improve access to geriatric psychiatry services. So whereas we have an outpatient clinic, we also have a number of outreach programs that I look forward to telling you about.
That's a great introduction. Tell us, Eve, How did you make the decision to be into the geriatric care field? Is there any
I have always been very interested, for whatever reason, in working with older adults. I have two teenage children that often say to me, "Mom, why do you talk to all the older adults everywhere we go, at church and in the grocery store?" And always very fond of my grandparents growing up. And however, it's very interesting. I did not give in to my interest in working with older adults because of some of the I was not encouraged to do that when I was in undergraduate school. But with some maturity and the opportunity to go to graduate school and focus and work with several of the geriatric psychiatrists, particularly Dr. Bill McDonald at Emory, was able to follow my passion, and here I am.
So you've been with the Fuqua Center since its inception. How did the opportunity come about for you to get involved?
While I was in graduate school, I actually did my clinical work at Emory and at Wesley Woods Geriatric Center, which is a part of Emory University and Emory Healthcare. So that's how I became involved, and also began to work with Dr. McDonald on the grant proposal to the Fuquas for the funding for the center to really expand what the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry was doing at that time, its focus being an academic medical center, research and teaching. We felt that there'd be added value and something that the department should do to provide community education and outreach. And Mr. Fuqua was very interested in the work of in geriatric psychiatry. Many of you have probably seen articles before his passing of his experiences with depression and his great concern for older adults who in their latter years may not have been able to live life to its fullest because of this medical illness.
Let's begin and tell us at a high level the issues, the topics that you would want to discuss in related to depression in the elderly. What are they, and where do we begin that conversation?
I think there's still we've made great progress. I think over the last decade, and people understanding that depression is a medical illness like other illnesses, that is not just a reflection of emotional or personality weaknesses, but it is a medical illness for many brought on. And Dr. Hamida will talk more about the etiology of depression in older adults prevalence. But there's still great resistance on the part of older adults to seek the services or to seek medical attention. There have been a number of surveys by mental health advocacy organizations that say that many older adults don't see it as a medical problem. They see it as a personality weakness or a lack of faith. And what I see most frequently in my practice, I think it's human nature to blame the feelings of depression and the symptoms of depression on something else that's going on, when it's often the opposite. It's the symptoms of depression and the illness itself that's causing many of the difficulties that they're experiencing in life, or their inability to problem solve, that kind of thing.
Is the center evolving as you kind of imagined it would? Because you've been around since the beginning. You must have had a picture in your head about how you would like it to be. Is it kind of matching up?
It is. Well, I guess when the center was first founded, we didn't really know what the future had to hold for us. It is evolving. I'm very proud of the services that we provide. We've trained hundreds of, or really thousands of, aging services personnel on how to screen, what the treatments are that are available, how to access care, how to advocate for older adults who may not see that they are experiencing an illness and need some assistance. We have become, we're looked to as a strong partner with aging services. We've partnered with our state Division of Aging Services, our local area agencies on aging, Georgia Homes and Services for the Aging, and others to help access older adults as best
we can. Is that common where you would work with the government agencies?
There's more of a push now for public-private partnerships, yes.
Right.
And that's how we've accessed actually more vulnerable older adult populations.
Because those people could slip through the cracks.
Exactly, exactly.
So, and what ways are you able to reach out to them now, or how does that partnership work?
We have trained numbers of in-home care managers, people that go in through a number of Medicaid waiver programs to provide services in homes of older adults, trained them how to recognize mental illness in older adults, make referrals, communicate with primary care providers and other mental health providers so that they don't kind of suffer in silence. We've also have private funding through the Jesse Parker Williams Foundation to put nurse practitioners in low-income housing developments. Several Atlanta Housing Authority residents, but more affordable low-income housing where many older adults live. So we try and access them that way. We also are part of the Georgia Telemedicine Partnership Program. So Dr. Hermida and our other geriatric psychiatrists and nurse practitioners are actually able to evaluate older adults long distance in many rural areas of the state that don't have access to a psychiatrist, much less a geriatric psychiatrist.
And then they can access them just via the telephone now.
Right. Well, via the telephone, but we actually do our evaluations over video conferencing equipment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So kind of Skype-like equipment.
That's good.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Eve, I know that earlier we had a conversation that depression, obviously, in the elderly is a large, complex issue. But you spoke of it also being an issue with caregivers. Can you elaborate on that?
I can. There's a very high rate among family caregivers of persons with chronic illnesses or caregivers of even children or adult disabled persons or spouses that may be experiencing chronic illnesses, cancers, or neurologic disorders. I think it's not simply because they're dealing with or working with someone and it's a sad situation. Frequently it's the emotional stress, but also the physical stress of that over a period of time that can cause the changes, and then the person would exhibit the symptoms of a major depressive illness. So it's very important that someone recognize that changes in their behavior or mood may be an illness and not just the fact that they are tired or fatigued.
I'm going to ask for some free clinical advice. As you know, we have a home care agency, caregivers going out into the home to take care of the elderly. What should Brad and I be looking for in our pool of caregivers in regards to what you just spoke of? Or is there an application there?
Are you talking about your professional caregivers?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
That's a great question. A lot of human resources departments are now looking at what are, you know, like you would screen for high blood pressure and screen for diabetes and other health issues. I mean, because of the prevalence of depression, you might consider education programs for your staff, possible even screening. Or at least they could do self-screening for depressive symptoms and education regarding where they might seek help.
Is there a rule of thumb regarding the amount of time a caregiver is with an individual when the depression kicks in?
I'm not aware of any. Dr.
Like,
Hermida, are you? I'm not aware of any.
A month or 3 months. I know I had a family member that was dealing with a spouse that was chronically ill. And then at first, you know, everybody's gung-ho and fired up about it. But then, you know, weeks turn to months, months turn to 6 months, and it's trying. It's like you had said. I mean, the caregiver is susceptible or likely to be depressed because of the care, the day-to-day care, plus their feelings about the, you know, sometimes resentment towards the person that's ill.
Is the level of support increases
right.
for a caregiver, and also the level of support that's provided from by the community or
right.
the larger family group falls
it's,
off.
Right, it's tough.
We see many caregivers in our practice who their life revolves around their caregiving
right.
of that individual and have very little time for any kind of respite or activities
right.
that they enjoy, things that really filled them up emotionally,
right.
kept them well physically, no longer they feel out of guilt or whatever, right. that it's a, or out of just limited resources, logistics, that they can do those things. So we do work a lot in our practice to try and encourage caregivers to get respite, to find time to get to their worship services, find time to get to their book groups and their girls' night out or man's night out or do right. those things that they need to do to fill themselves back up. So
but does the depression typically come in like after 1 month, 3 months, or there, everybody's different?
I think everybody's different. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on people's support and predisposition to depressed mood, the level of the stress. I don't think there's a
rule of thumb.
Rule of thumb there.
Let me segue over to Dr. Hamida. Do you see any particular time frame or situation that would bring on these episodes of depression within the older population?
Yeah, that's a very good question regarding what is the rule of thumb. You know, how many months, how many years, and there's so many factors that could be contributing to this. Okay. You know, one is personal resilience, you know, personal experiences, other supports, you know, the level of disability. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much time the caregiver has to invest in taking care of the family member. And what is very interesting is that we see more prevalence of depression in caregivers who are taking care of patients who have actually more disturbed behaviors, like okay. psychosis or paranoia or any kind of, these kind of behaviors are actually more, we see more stress in the family members than just depression. But any kind of caregiving situation could be really just a triggering factor for depression.
Let me take that thought back to Brad and my cause. We have many clients who are Alzheimer's and dementia. And would we have a tendency to see that same possibility of depression in our caregivers with that type of patient, as you were just speaking of? Would we or could we expect that?
To see depression in
yes,
the
ma'am.
Caregivers? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And as I said, there are just so many factors mm-hmm. involved that it's really hard to specify, you know, this is the time frame. Mm-hmm. It's just about also how people experience their feelings is so different, you know, into their own life experiences. As Eve said earlier, vulnerability, genetics, kind of support and individual way of expressing emotions and dealing with the stress.
Okay.
So
yeah.
it's hard to put a time frame.
Yeah. Eve, let me just come back to you for a minute. And what advice would you give to a family caregiver, a spouse that is dealing with a chronically ill spouse and, maybe feeling depressed or frustrated or maybe, you know, a notion that better days are behind them? What kind of advice would you give to someone like that?
I don't think that a caregiver can give up everything that is makes them who they are in order to be a caregiver. I often tell or work with my patients in saying that the longer you take care of yourself, the longer you'll be able to caregive or be the kind of caregiver you want to be for the person that you love and are responsible for taking care of. And that's really hard. I think sometimes it's really hard when people are in those situations. They've lost a relationship that they once had with that loved one. They're put in situations and that are very difficult in caring for that person. They intend to be a nurse and find themselves doing very difficult things for family members or others. And it's just, I think that my advice would be to really find time it's not too much to ask of another family member or a friend or a church member or pay someone so that you can have some time to do the things that make you who you are and that fill you up. You spoke a little bit about professional caregivers, that's their work. We have to remember as employees that a lot of our professional caregivers go home and are caregivers at home as well, of children and aging adults and parents or other family members. So helping them as well to find time to take care of themselves is, I think, extraordinarily important. And when people do, they'll often say they'll feel that their mood elevates. We'll have patients come back in and say, oh, gosh, when I get to go with out with my sorority sisters, I'm thinking of a patient in my, I have a patient in mind, or I got to my Sunday or Wednesday night church supper, I just could feel myself, my mood elevate and feel like as if I had some energy, and it makes a huge difference. However, that doesn't always treat the depression. If there's a there is a more moderate or severe depressed mood with numbers of symptoms, problems with sleep and appetite and those kinds of things, probably medical attention is indicated.
We appreciate that. That's very sound, solid advice. If we have some of our listeners who have a loved one that could be experiencing the depression, how may they contact you or the Fuqua Center?
They can contact the Fuqua Center through our website. It's www.fuqacenter.org. For patients or for patient appointments through our practice, the entry number line is 404-728-6302. If you just have simple questions about depression and not looking for an appointment, you can still reach us through that number as well. But the website is a wealth of information on depression and services that are available and providers that are in the across the state that are available.
Thank you, Eva. I certainly appreciate it. Next, we're going to move directly to Dr. Hamida. Though we spoke earlier, won't you begin by giving us a little bit of your background and how did you make the decision to get into the field that you're in?
All right. Well, thanks so much for inviting us today. I'm Adriana Hermida. I'm originally from Colombia, South America. I have been in the United States for the past 10 years, most of those years in Chicago, doing residency in psychiatry and geriatric psychiatry fellowship. But I have been with Emory University for the past couple of years, a little bit more than 2 years, working in the geriatric division and seeing patients in the outpatient clinic, seeing patients in the assisted living facilities, nursing homes, and also teaching medical students, residents, and fellows.
Interesting combination there, teaching students and then practicing on the elderly. Vast contrast. How do you balance that? And are there any likes between the two populations?
Well, it is really interesting because initially the first reaction of the medical students and residents, their experiences, like they are not really very drawn into geriatric psychiatry, but after coming with us and learning what we do and how we make so many changes in those people's lives, you know, and how they feel and how they get better, they get more motivated into coming and learning more about this. Right. And so we combine the clinical practice with the teaching, so it goes together.
How did you come to make that decision to be in the field?
Well, ever since I went to medical school, I was very drawn into learning about human behavior and psychiatry, so I had no doubt that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. But it was just until I did some research at the University of Chicago during my residency. I did some research in Alzheimer's disease and mild cognitive impairment, which is very mild memory problems, and detecting early dementia with some neuroimaging is when I got very interested in doing geriatric psychiatry and working with this population. And ever since, I've been in love with the field.
That's interesting. Tell us if you can, and this is a real general question, but what is a day in the life of Dr. Hermida? Tell us, just kind of begin at 8 o'clock in the morning and walk us through it if you could.
Very hectic life. And actually sometimes it starts at 7 a.m.
Okay.
So it's really a challenge, you know, as you mentioned earlier, trying to balance, I mean, teaching and just doing research and seeing patients on top of being a mother, you know, so lots of things. I mean, usually just seeing patients in the clinic, doing some outreach, as Eve mentioned earlier, going to assisted living facilities, nursing homes, and independent living facilities, giving some lectures and teaching the fellows, and kind of balancing out all of those things, you know. But it sometimes starts really early, and what is good is just at the end of the day you feel so much reward after just helping so many people.
I want to ask the same question I asked Eve, because it comes home to roost in my house. What should I, as a overseer, professional caregivers, what should I look for in my caregivers in relationship to potential depression?
Well, there are several things that we want to probably bring up right now, and one of those is that many times in the elderly patients, and some of the caregivers may be older than 60, mm-hmm. so they may qualify as a geriatric themselves, depression can present very differently than depression in the younger population. We usually think about depression as all being sad and depressed and crying all the time and when you have suicidal thoughts. But sometimes in the geriatric patients, depression presents without sadness, without feeling sad all the time. So it could present only with not having energy or not having any motivation to do anything or losing appetite or poor sleep. But when you ask them, do you feel sad or do you feel depressed, they say no.
Mm-hmm.
So it could present very differently. So this is one thing to keep in mind, not only in caregivers but in patients who are older. That's why it's sometimes challenging to recognize depression.
Yeah, it seems to me, and please correct me if I'm saying this incorrectly or making a false assumption, it's an art of what you do versus a science. I look at an orthopedist, it's a science. You go through a certain process to get to an end where you have to be able to recognize very abstract type of situations.
It definitely is a science. It's an art.
Yeah.
And what is interesting is that it's an art that you're working with someone who is even having some difficulty recognizing themselves what's going on, you know. So when you go to the orthopedics, I mean, the patient knows, I mean, they have a broken leg, you know, mm-hmm. and they recognize it and they want to get it fixed. So it's more challenging for us because the patients don't recognize it, and if they recognize it, they're afraid of looking look for help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't even want to think they need a psychiatrist, you know. They don't want to think themselves as people think, you know. If you see a psychiatrist, you mean you're crazy, which is not really what it is.
Right.
But still the stigma, this is what we are really fighting with the Fuqua Center. I mean, mm-hmm. really trying to decrease stigma, making these services more available to people who have low income or low level of education, and being able to be there for them and helping them in having a better life.
Can you talk a little bit about treatment options when they are diagnosed?
There are different modalities of treatment once patients have been diagnosed with depression. One is doing psychotherapy. There are different types of psychotherapy, like cognitive behavioral therapy, insight-oriented therapy, psychodynamic psychotherapy. So once you recognize that a patient may need therapy, you have to tailor the type of therapy to that patient and whatever their needs are. We also have all the type of treatments like is pharmacotherapy, so taking antidepressants. Other new type of treatments include transcranial magnetic stimulation. We have electroconvulsive therapy. And we also have DBS, which is deep brain stimulation. So there are different variety of therapeutic interventions that could be used for different patients.
Can you talk a little bit more about the electroconvulsive therapy? Because I think a lot of people hear the term shock treatment and they think it's barbaric, and they, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding there. Maybe you can set the record straight.
Well, I'm very glad you're asking the question, because when people think about electroconvulsive therapy, they immediately think about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know. They immediately picture that is just a traumatic treatment or barbaric treatment, like you said. But the truth is that we do it very differently. I mean, we do it, the patient is under general anesthesia. They don't really feel anything. They really don't have a convulsion or a seizure. They don't move like having a seizure. I mean, they may have a seizure in the brain to be able to treat the condition. But it's actually a very effective treatment. We do have a response rate up to 80% of response rate with electroconvulsive therapy, while with pharmacotherapy sometimes is about like 35% of response. People are always afraid of shock therapy or even considering having this type of treatment, but it is very effective. And when we really determine that a patient needs this type of treatment, it's because, I mean, they probably have failed other type of treatments before, and or patients need acute improvement. They cannot wait for an antidepressant to kick in for 6 or 8 weeks to feel better. So,
is this kind of therapy where you do it one time and then that's it, or is this a kind of an ongoing treatment?
Well, usually for an acute treatment, on an acute course of ECT, we do anywhere from 6 to 12.
Mm-hmm. And over what period of time?
Sometimes 3 times a week, mm-hmm. sometimes 2 times a week. It depends on the type of electroconvulsive therapy that we are using. There are different modalities too. And after 6 treatments, they may very well just stop the treatments and do well, or they may need a little bit longer treatments like maintenance ECT. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit more complicated when they have had different or several acute courses of ECT. They may need just maintenance ECT to keep them well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hermina, being a physiology major here, can you tell me and our listeners what is, how is the therapy effective? What does it do from a physiology standpoint?
Well, that's like a...
And keep it simple for us.
That's a $1 million question. I mean, just because we don't really know how electroconvulsive therapy works,
that's
actually.
That's an honest answer. Okay.
We do know that there are different hypotheses. I mean, one is the anticonvulsant hypothesis, and is as we treat some patients with mood disorders with anti-seizure medications or mood stabilizers. The ECT basically works like a mood stabilizer. I mean, it increases the seizure threshold, mm-hmm. so it works like an anticonvulsant. There are different other theories, like increasing the serotonin in the brain or normalizing different pathways in the brain. So it still is in hypothesis. We know it works, but we don't know for sure how it works.
Do you know any of the history? Like, who was the first guy that said, hey, let's shock the brain a little to see what happens?
I know a lot about history. Well, actually, it was in the 1700s when the first seizure was induced with camphor to treat a manic episode. Mm-hmm. And in 1934, two Italian scientists, Cerletti and Bini, actually were the ones who treated patients with electricity. Before that, there were some hypoglycemic episodes that were induced with insulin, and patients actually improved at that time. So that was before ECT. Uh-huh. Then, as I said, in 1934, these two Italian scientists, discovered that with electricity they could induce the seizure. In the 40s, it became widely used in the United States, but at that time we didn't have any other medications available. So it was used to treat many conditions. Mm. And about in the 80s, it became, again, widely used. And as I said, we do it very differently than in the 40s or in the 30s.
I would hope.
When it started, but we do it we have the ECT suite, which is pretty much like an OR, like a recovery room. And we have anesthesiologists involved. And it's very short. I mean, it's a very short treatment, anywhere from 20 seconds to less than 2 minutes every session. But as I said, it's a very effective treatment, and is usually more effective for the elderly.
Takes longer to come in and out of the anesthesia than for the treatment itself.
That's right.
It sounds like you've done a lot of research and you continue to be involved in that. What does the future hold for treatment of late life depression?
I think that the future of late life depression is like the future for depression in general, Not only expanding treatments with pharmacotherapy, like more medications are available, but also exploring like transcranial magnetic stimulation or deep brain stimulation. These are the type of treatments that are available for, as I said, not only for the geriatric, for the younger population. But the most important thing in the geriatric population is to be able to identify depression, to be able to recognize depression. And the sooner the patients get treatment, the better the outcome.
Is there any work being done to try to predict depression in certain individuals or prevent depression in certain individuals?
Well, as science evolves, you know, I mean, as science progresses, I think that there's some kind of genetics, you know, I mean, trying to identify certain genes or sure. that would predispose you to be depressed. Right now, I mean, people are doing a lot of research in this area, but it's the same as discovering or recognizing early on patients who are at risk to develop Alzheimer's. So I think it's all a lot of these things are just evolving, are just in research right now. But that would be an interesting area of, I mean, an interesting area to explore, you know, people, sure. how you could recognize even before the patient gets to the right. point of being depressed, or how could you identify patients before they develop Alzheimer's?
You know, I want to go back, and I'm not sure I have a question here, but something you said earlier about the fact that the depression presents itself differently in the elderly, and that there's often no accompanying sadness or feelings of desperation. And I think it's, you know, people like to self-diagnose, you know, mm-hmm. they always want to try to analyze what's going on with their own body. And I think this has a high potential for being misdiagnosed because of the fact that there's no feelings of sadness or desperation.
That's right. And what I don't want to generalize that all the geriatric patients would present that way with depression. You know, many patients, of course, present with the classic symptoms of sadness, I mean, lack of energy, anhedonia, not enjoying what they used to enjoy before. But it's important to lower the threshold when we are trying to diagnose depression mm-hmm. in the elderly, just because what you said, you know, I mean, it presents differently. It has different symptoms. It has different phenotype. Hmm.
Dr. Hermina, if we were to ask you what, from a professional standpoint, piece of advice that you might give our listeners who could be experiencing this, what would that be?
Well, number one, recognize any changes in behavior, not just depression, not just sadness, but recognizing any changes of behavior. And ask for professional help. You know, once you recognize that your dad, I mean, it's acting differently, or your mom is just not herself, not just assume that it's just because they are getting old and it's normal as part of aging. It's not normal. It's not normal to be depressed when you're old. And it's not normal just to say, okay, well, why wouldn't they be depressed? You know, they are in a nursing home. They have cancer. They just lost their spouse. You know, but in other words, recognize the symptoms and look for professional help.
Okay. And if we have listeners who would like to contact you or the center, can we use the same contact information from Eve, or is there a different means of doing so?
Same contact information. I think that they can get a lot of information through the website, through the Fuqua website, and all the numbers are there in case that they need any other help.
We thank you. Great conversation. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Our next guest is Jamie Lackey. Jamie is from Emory Eastside, Eastside Heritage Hospital, which is a part of the Emory system. She works in the behavioral science areas. It's a nice segue over to her. So tell us, Jamie, a little bit about your background, how did you get to where you are, and just begin there.
Well, thank you for having me this morning. I am a social worker by training. I have a master's degree in social work. I'm a clinical social worker at our behavioral health unit, where I specialize in geriatric inpatient treatment for geriatrics who are senior population that are experiencing those signs and symptoms of depression that get to the point where it's acute enough that outpatient is no longer what is needed, and they now need to move into an inpatient phase where we can treat it more acutely and quickly. I've been doing that for about 4 years now at Emory Eastside, and like I said, I'm part of our behavior health unit.
How did you make the decision to do this as a career?
I've always wanted to be a social worker from a very young age. It's always the field I wanted to go into, but going into geriatrics, it kind of just fell into my lap. It was a great opportunity to get to do that. I believe very strongly in taking care of our senior population. They've helped pave the way for all of us and our education and our opportunities, and I just really feel like they're a special population that deserves to be treated and cared for, and enjoy doing that.
Well, let me back up here. I just looked down at my notes and saw that an undergraduate degree from Tennessee and a graduate degree from UGA.
Absolutely.
Now, how do you balance those two, and how do you?
There's no balance. I'm a Tennessee girl. I've been in Georgia for 10 years, but I'll always cheer for Tennessee. So.
Can you walk us through kind of a day in the life of your day? Because that would be interesting to hear.
Absolutely. I work on our inpatient unit, which is located out in Snellville, Georgia, where we are a licensed inpatient unit. As a social worker, our job there is to begin with seeing the patient, doing a social assessment on them, finding out about their history, what was their life like, what were they before they became ill, and what was going on, get to know their families, find their family strengths and their community strengths and the strength that they'll have to rely on when they leave the hospital. I also participate in doing group therapy for our higher functioning patients that can walk through, you know, how do you deal with this anxiety? How do you deal with this depression when you're not in the hospital? And how can we get you stronger while you're here? So we do group therapy. And then we also do a lot of discharge planning. You know, what level of care do you need when you leave? What follow-up services do you need? You know, is the environment that you're in, is that the most structured environment that you can benefit from? And how do we help you access those resources that are in the community?
That's really good. I know that that Eastside that has clinical staff, has professionals. Can you tell us who the lead physician may be and give him a little background there?
I'm sure we have in our at our behavior health unit right now, we're specializing in geriatrics. We will be moving into adult mental health in the future, but right now focusing on the geriatric standpoint, we have two physicians that are currently that see our inpatients, Dr. Pack and Dr. Val. Dr. Pack is our medical director, and they are both geriatric psychiatrists specializing in geriatrics.
It's interesting. As I again, I'm going to take you back because I, as I'm glancing over the bio that you did for us, I see that you that your mom was a volunteer, and I assume she probably coerced you into the same kind of volunteering. But it's just interesting. So many people that are in this field start on a volunteer basis.
Sure. My mom actually is, you know, was a professional and had a professional job, was a CPA, and she was always very active in the community. And I kind of went where she went, you know, when she was on the board of directors somewhere, when she was, you know, when we were doing things through our church. And it just, it always felt natural and felt, you know, it felt like something I wanted to do. So I really do credit her for, and my father for getting me, you know, into that and giving back to my community. And it's just always been very important for me.
It's obvious, Jamie, that with what you and our previous guests do, it's a very, very stressful time. It must be a extremely difficult time. What do you find rewarding? What recharges your battery to keep going?
I think it is, you know, it is a very stressful time when you're looking at families. You know, oftentimes you're looking, you know, like Eve said about with the caregiver, you know, we work very closely with those caregivers as well. It's adult children often who are providing that care for their loved one, and that's a very stressful situation. It can be a role reversal at times. You're now recognizing signs and symptoms in your parents and trying to get them help, whereas growing up, they raised you. And it's a very stressful situation for both individuals. The patient that's coming in with these symptoms, they don't necessarily, they're glad their children are there to help, but it's frustrating to them that they now have to be the one that needs help instead of giving that help. So every day, you know, there's that stressor and that tension in that relationship, and it's overwhelming. And I think one of the blessings that we get to do at the Heritage Center is help these families and these patients, you know, walk through this process. How do you walk through it? How can I make this moment in time the best moment in time for you? How can we get you the services you need to give you that chance that there's, you know, there's better, it's going to get better. We're going to walk you through this. We're going to give you the resources you need, and we'll work for you. And that's what it is. At the end of the day, when you know you've provided some of that reassurance, you know, if you're talking about dementia or all, you know, a specific type, you know, Alzheimer's, we can't reverse that, but there is depression and there are symptoms related to that you can treat, and you can help them walk through that and give them some relief.
Kind of what you were saying there kind of answered a question that I wanted to ask you, but maybe you can elaborate on it. You know, I'm sure you see patients who are either on hospice or, as you say, with Alzheimer's, which, of course, can't be reversed. How do you instill hope in someone when they have a terminal illness?
You know, it's a very difficult thing to do. And I think a lot of it, like even Dr. Amin were talking about, it's that resiliency factor that the family has. But, you know, like you said, there's some things that you can't reverse, but we try to focus on their strengths and their positives. What can we do to make what's going on better? You know, there is hope for those symptoms that are related to the dementia, you know, the psychosis that may come, the depression that may come, you know, to try to relieve and alleviate those symptoms. And a lot of times, just reducing those symptoms and alleviating some of those symptoms is the hope that they need to keep going. You know, it's a fix to a larger problem. You help relieve that symptom, and they're feeling better. You may not be able to cure the overlying diagnosis of dementia, but you can help alleviate those immediate symptoms, which provides a lot of reassurance.
In regards to the role reversal, how do you address the children to step up, to become the parent now versus the child?
I think one thing I hear a lot, and I think, you know, the social workers I work with, we hear a lot, was what, you know, I promised, you know, mom or dad, you know, or the grandparent, whoever it is they're caring for, that we would, you know, never, you know, place them in a nursing home or assisted living, or we'd always do this. And so I still feel like I have to honor those wishes. And a lot of times it's just providing them with education that you are caring for them. You know, you're still giving them the care they need. And you make promises sometimes when people are healthy before you know what their best care is. And that's our job, is to say, this is their ultimate level of care that they need to be successful. And so I think that helps them make those hard decisions. You know, do we stay home? How much inpatient treatment do we get, outpatient treatment? You just educate them on what the needs are so they feel like they're being empowered to make that right decision for their parent. They're helping them just by doing that and knowing what their care needs are.
You make a really good point about making promises, because I think a lot of us do that with our parents, or our parents may make comments to us about things like that, and I think it would be a pretty good piece of advice to withhold your carte blanche promises, mm-hmm. Not knowing what the future might hold.
But how do you do that? A lot of people who make those promises they're uninformed promises, because they haven't been through it, or, you know, they imagine things a certain way, or maybe they in their head think, you know, assisted living is not as good as it can be, or, you know, they don't really understand what they're promising, but in their mind they're thinking, oh, well, I'm making them feel at ease, or I'm making them feel more comfortable. How do you coach the families? Like, should you be having these conversations way early on, or maybe, you know, touring an assisted living, you know, 20 years before you need to, just to see what it's like, because you don't really know?
Well, I think that's one of the best things you can do, is sit down. And I think it's with, you know, any healthcare situation that you're in, not just dementia, Alzheimer's, any chronic illness, before the illness takes control and is so overwhelming that you can't make good decisions, educate yourself about what is out there. You know, what are your beliefs as your family system? What do you think is the best for your family? Have that honest conversation and find information that's available out there, you know, about the illness that you're facing, so that you know long term what you're looking at. And yes, absolutely, have that conversation early on. Know what the needs are. Try to recognize what it is. You don't have to have gone through the experience before to make an informed decision.
Right. I'll tell you, we see it in here a lot of the hospice people, the challenges they have and the good work that they do. And that's not even on the radar of mm-hmm. most people when it should be.
Mm. It is. We always try to, you know, encourage people to, you know, think about your living will, and if they don't have one, how to prepare one. And again, while you're healthy enough to make that decision and you're not in an emotional crisis, the worst right. time to make that decision is when you're in an emotional crisis.
Right.
Now, I know you get some direct opportunity to support families and patients by running an Alzheimer's support group. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Once a month, it's the second Thursday of every month, I run an Alzheimer's caregiver support group that's sponsored through the Alzheimer's Association, but it's held at Emory Eastside Heritage Center. And, you know, it's a very open-ended group where we have caregivers that they don't have to be a part of the hospital. Their patient, their loved one doesn't have to be a patient in their hospital. It's anybody in the community is welcome. And, you know, it's just really a time for them to process what's been going on this last month. What stress am I facing? Like Eve said, these caregivers get overwhelmed and it becomes their life instead of part of their life, and they let it overwhelm them. And so I try not to do a whole lot of talking. I'm there to facilitate, and they really rely on each other to get that strength from each other. Oh, well, my loved one did this. Oh, really? What helped? How did you do that?
Right.
So they meet and they form these bonds, and it's a time for them to have their space and their time and do good self-care.
Tell us once again, you said that it's open to anyone, not just patients of Heritage.
Correct.
Tell us the times and dates and the location.
It is the second Thursday of every month at 1 p.m., and it meets on the second floor in our boardroom at Emory Eastside Heritage Center.
How much of your time do you spend with the families as opposed to actual patients?
Both. I do a lot of both. Both. It's very mixed because, like I said, I see my patients every day. I'm around with the physician, and I see my patients every day many times throughout the day to see how they're doing, how their day's progressing, do they have any needs. And then we spend a lot of time updating the families who are so overwhelmed, how their loved one is doing, what we're seeing, what we think they need to see in the future. And then a lot of times we will do family conferences with the doctor, myself, and the family to talk about this was the hospital, you know, treatment course, and this is what we're recommending to make sure we're all on the same page and we're doing the right thing.
Very good. And also, I know that you have a story for us.
Are you, the story about how I've impacted someone's life?
Yeah.
Sure. You know, it's been a couple of years now. Probably when I first started 2 or 3 years ago, we had a gentleman who I still am involved with from time to time who came in. And, you know, you see this a lot. A patient that has no family really involved. They've outlived their family. They've lost ties with their family. Or they have a long history of mental illness and have burned those bridges. And they don't have a lot of support. But they're at a point where they can't take care of themselves anymore due to their, you know, whatever illness they have, the depression. They need that structure. They need that help. And we were able to help get this gentleman into a great assisted living, linked him with a care manager in the community that really advocated for him, helped him get VA benefits so he could pay for his care. We helped him get his medication. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's really found a family with where he lives now, and he has ongoing care. And it's amazing to see that, you know, every now and then I'll still see him, and he's doing well. And it makes you feel good to know that at the end of the day, you've made a positive impact on someone's life.
How important is the VA in these kind of situations?
It's very important. A lot of people don't know what's out there. When we do our psychosocial assessments, we're always asking, were you a veteran or was your spouse a veteran? Because there's VA benefits out there that help pay for us either assisted living or that in-home care for caregivers to come in. And it's a huge benefit in educating yourself about that and learning how to navigate the VA system can be difficult, but there are people out there that can help with that.
And your group can help them?
We can help link them with folks that are trained by the Veterans Administration, yes.
Tell us if we have listeners out there who are looking for advice in regards to their loved ones, what piece of advice might you give them to move them along, so to speak?
Well, I think, you know, similarly what Dr. Armito was saying was, you know, recognize these symptoms early, whether it's, you know, dementia, whether it's depression, you know, whatever that is, recognize those symptoms early, and finding a good geriatric psychiatrist that knows how to deal with the geriatric population, because like we've been saying all along, this presents itself very differently, and it's it's vocalized very differently, their symptoms and their feelings very differently from a younger population. So knowing a good geriatric psychiatrist, finding a good board-certified geriatric psychiatrist is a great way to get started.
I think that point that you just made, you know, as when we have children, we have a specialist that take care of children, mm-hmm. pediatricians. We grow into our senior years, we're probably still using the same general practitioner mm-hmm. that we've used for the last 30 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We need to make a change. Very good.
Okay.
If our listeners would like to contact you, how could they do so? How can they get a hold of the Heritage Center?
If you have general questions about whether or not you're appropriate and you need, you know, your loved one needs inpatient treatment and you're just curious about that, our assessment office is 770-985-6470, and that'll get you to our assessment office, and they can help screen you for, you know, appropriateness for inpatient hospitalization. But if you just have general questions, you can look on our website, which is www.emoryeastside.com, and there'll be links to our behavioral health unit and how you can contact us and what services we provide.
Great. We certainly appreciate all the information, and thanks to all of our guests for tuning in today. Once again, if you want to listen to the broadcast, you can do so at eugeriaradio.com. And remember, if the youth of our nation are our greatest natural resource, the seniors of our nation are our greatest national treasure. Thank you, and have a great day.
Eugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and is recorded in the Business Radio X Studios.